Good afternoon. Sorry to break up any conversation. I call this meeting of the House Finance Committee to order. I'll let the record reflect that it is 1:33 p.m. on Wednesday, the 5th of March, 2025. Present today are Representative Hannon, Representative Johnson, Representative Bynum, Representative Stapp, Representative Tomaszewski, Representative Galvin, Representative Jimmy, and my two co-chairs, Co-Chair Foster and Co-Chair Schrage. Also present today are our House Finance Committee staff, Committee Assistant Helen Phillips, Paige Reed, Gardiner, Secretary Bree Wiley, Secretary Leah Frazier. Before we start, please mute your cell phones. Today's meeting, we will hear the Legislative Finance Division present a three-year budget outlook. Before we begin, I thought I'd offer a comment about the three-year outlook. The first is, in my mailbox downstairs on the floor, members received from the Department of Revenue, Volume 13, January 2025, Alaska's Economy. And there's some news in here that is favorable about increased oil production. Alaska's labor market thrives amid national slowdown, et cetera. Alaska sees 7,700 more jobs. The only reason I do that is this presentation is, in my view, it's a little bit glum. It's not all good news. We have a lot of work to do to get our state FISC in proper form. And I remember that we have, because I remember it every day, that we have the largest sovereign wealth fund. We have no broad-based tax, for better or worse, and we distribute a permanent fund dividend. And no other state can say one of those things. I guess New Hampshire comes close on the broad-based tax issue. So it might be interesting to ask the director at some point whether the other 49 states would also have presentations like this that give us pause and ask us, you know, how we get through the morass, because it's going to feel a little bit like that. So that's my editorial. And with that, Director Painter, if you'll come forward. Yes. Representative Hannon.
Thank you. Just before we get started with Mr. Painter, you referenced something that was in your mailbox that I don't think I got. So if I'm looking for it, you said it was the Department of Revenue publication?
It certainly is. Oh, you know what? It's First National Bank of Alaska. I apologize.
It's from the Bankers.
Okay. Yes. But it includes a lot of references to Department of Revenue.
Okay. But not all of us.
So the First National Bank of Alaska is feeling
they did not give it
auspicious.
It was not in my mailbox today. Okay.
We can fix that. Director Painter.
Thank you. Mr. Chairman, for the record, Alexei Painter. I'm the legislative fiscal analyst. So first we're going to cover the revenue outlook for the state. The spring revenue forecast is expected out next week, so we'll be talking a little bit about what that may look like. We'll talk about our cost drivers and agency operations, statewide items, the capital budget, and then I'll present some scenarios developed by the co-chairman for the next few years. So starting with the revenue outlook. So this graph on the top, or the table, shows the Department of Revenue fall forecast for the next few years, so the current year, FY25 through FY28. So the percent of market value draw is our largest source of unrestricted general fund revenue. All the other revenue sources are below that, getting to our total revenue. And you can see the oil price assumption. So the FY26 revenue forecast of about $6.2 billion is built on a $70 oil price. And North Slope production of about 470,000 barrels a day. Below, you'll see a comparison over this same time period of the DOR forecast to a couple of external forecasts. So you can see, is that in the range we should expect for the spring? The blue line is that fall forecast of starting out $73.86 in FY25, and then $70 in FY26, and then $69 in each of FY27 and 28. The red line is the futures market for Brent, which is the kind of international standard. That's what ANS, Alaska North Slope Crude, is often pegged to, although we have some differential. We generally trade along with that. It's sort of the standard for waterborne crude, as it's called, the crude that's going on tankers. And so that red line you can see starts out a little bit above where our forecast was for the remainder of FY25, and then is a little bit below, about a dollar below. This is as of Friday. If you run it a different day, you'll get a slightly different amount, but you know, a dollar or two is not too far off. The green line is the Energy Information Agency's short-term energy outlook. They update this quarterly. This is the one from February 11th, so it's the most recent version. And it shows, it predicts that by the end of calendar year 2026, prices will go down to the mid-60s. That's based on an assumption that production globally will increase, and sure enough, we've seen some announcements from OPEC implying that production is going to increase. And the EIA has an assumption that demand is not going to significantly increase, so that the result is lower prices. And so if you compare these forecasts, you can see that it's hard to look at the DOR fall forecast and say that looks, you know, gloomy compared to other forecasts. We could see a spring forecast that shows a lower price or a comparable price. Fairly unlikely, unless things change radically in the next couple of days, that we'll see a spring forecast that's higher than what we were dealing with in the fall.
Representative Galvin.
Thank you, Co-Chair Josephson. And I know that this line here, the fourth line, oil price, is such an important line in terms of accessible dollars for us and our budgeting. And I also understand that it's pretty complex to make predictions. So I think, for the public's sake, I'd like to hear how certain you are about these numbers.
Through the chair, Representative Calvin.
Director Payne.
Not certain at all. Oil can be extremely volatile. Occasionally, we'll have stretches where it looks like it settled into a certain price level. Certainly, things have not changed significantly since the fall forecast was developed in December. So we've had a few months at a relatively stable price. There's been a lot of uncertainty in the global markets. I think the oil market doesn't know which way to go, but there's a lot of uncertainty. You know, it's very easy to imagine prices a year from now being $10 higher, $10 lower, with very plausible sounding reasons for why that happened based on things we don't now know. So I would not at all be surprised if this forecast is $10 off for a year from now.
Follow up.
We've got a big slide deck. Go ahead.
I'll pass.
Okay. Slide four.
Okay, so the next slide talks about sources of revenue uncertainty. So oil price is the one we've been talking about. Based on the current price, the $70 forecast, every dollar change in the price of oil means about $35 to $40 million in revenue. So where I said, you know, hey, I could see prices being $10 plus or minus, you know, that's $350 to $400 million above or below the forecast that we could very easily see that difference a year from now. But there's other variables as well. Oil production is one where especially production in those legacy fields that have the a lot of the production, if those go down and if the production is lower than expected, then we could see significantly less revenue. Because we have a production tax that's based on a profits tax, the marginal changes in production are less of a big driver than prices, because a dollar change in the price, even though percentage-wise that's not huge, it gets you to a higher profitability level, whereas production going up and down doesn't do that quite as much. The other thing that can change from forecast to forecast is the costs that are experienced by producers. So if you recall our overview presentation or Department of Revenue's forecast presentation, they are now projecting significantly higher both capital and operating expenses for operators on the North Slope than they did a year ago. And that also impacts our production tax amount because of the profits tax. The other driver of our UGF revenue, the major one, is investment returns. Since the permanent fund is our largest revenue source, if investment returns overperform or underperform projections, that makes a difference in revenue. Because of the lag in the percent of market value draw, we don't see that immediately. So the FY26 percent of market value draw from the permanent fund, or POMV draw, is based on fiscal years ending FY24, so the 5 years ending in FY24. So no matter what happens this year, that amount for FY26 is set. But if the permanent fund underperforms its projection by 1% for FY25, you would see an impact in FY27. It'd be about $8 million for each percent. And then that would be 1 year of the five-year average. So as you move through in FY28, that'd be a $16 million difference because it'd be 2 years of the average. So the percent of market value draw is a lot more stable because it's based on the total value of the fund. You know, 1%, meaning an $8 million difference, is not that big, and there's a delay. So it's not quite as volatile as oil revenue. Another source of revenue we don't often think about as revenue is federal revenue. But in fact, that's actually our largest source of revenue in the budget this year, larger than unrestricted general fund revenue. And so we'll be talking about potential changes in federal funds throughout this presentation based on things that are going on in Washington, D.C. that could greatly impact our overall revenue. In FY25, federal funds exceeded general funds, and in FY26, it's about $6.1 billion total between the operating and capital budgets. So very significant amount of money, about the same as our unrestricted general funds.
Okay. Slide 5, Representative Stout.
Thank you, Co-Chair Justin, to the Chair and to Director Painter. A couple of things here, and I'm sure we'll get into them as the presentation goes on. Firstly, I know we were mentioning spring revenue forecast a little bit ago. I did see that OPEC is boosting production substantially. They said that about 2 days ago, and now that both Brent and WTI prices are below 70, and they look like they're headed to stay there. So, and what would a $10 drop in price do over the course of a year to our revenues? Could I use the same calculation to say roughly $400 million through the chair?
Through the chair, Representative Stapp, yes. That rule holds for about $10 plus or minus. Beyond that, you get into, you'd have to use a different rule of thumb. But $10, it should be about right.
Thanks.
Okay. Slide 5.
Okay, so this is kind of reiterating something we covered back in the overview, but maybe significant as we're trying to build what's a realistic scenario this year. Last year, there were some significant one-time items in the budget, some of which we see repeated in the governor's budget, other of which we see repeated in likely forms at the end of the session. One of that was K-12 outside the formula funds. There was nearly $175 million of that. That was a one-time item. It's not part of the formula. It has to be added back this year if there's to be additional money. Another significant one was the R1 research project for University of Alaska. That was a multi-year project in the operating budget at $14.6 million. And so that counts against our FY25 budget, but it will be available. The governor is asking for another $5 million for that particular item. Another is the Alaska Marine Highway System backstop. With the volatility of whether we'll get the full federal grant or not, last year in the enacted budget, there was a $10 million backstop in case we didn't meet the full grant. And in fact, that backstop was triggered based on the actual grant amount. That is not repeated because it's a one-time item and is not present in the governor's budget. There's $7.5 million for the child care grant program. And these are grants that were going to providers. The governor's budget does include $6.1 million for child care assistance grants. Those are needs-based grants. That's related to Senate Bill 189, a fiscal note to a bill that passed last year. That bill is being challenged in court as a potential violation of the single subject rule, so it's unclear whether in the final, by the end of session, we'll even have certainty about whether that bill is actually going to take effect or not. But there's no... That $7.5 million is not repeated in the budget, which is going to providers. What is the $6.1 million that goes to for the needs-based amounts. Another significant one-time item was K-12 additional pupil transportation funds. So there was one-time $7.3 million going out. Again, that's a one-time item like the outside the formula foundation money. And then finally, there was $5 million for tourism marketing in general funds. There are a host of other items, but these are the ones that kind of arbitrarily said $5 million or more. And again, that one is not repeated in the governor's budget. So if you'd like those funds back, it'd be an addition above the governor's numbers.
Director, I'll ask real quickly. The items you've listed on slide 5, except for $5 million for R1 are simply not in either the budget or the amended budget, correct?
Mr. Chairman, that's correct.
All right. And so you can't know the administration's mindset any more than I can, but it shouldn't come as any great shock that some of these things would be. I mean, invariably, the budget was going to grow, in all likelihood, from the governor's amended budget.
Mr. Chairman, I think that's fair to say, given that you know the governor has legislation that would add significant K-12 funding, both inside the formula and for the pupil transportation formula and other items. So, you know, we'll talk about those fiscal notes later. But you know, the governor is proposing legislation that would be $100+ million for K-12 items. So it's certainly not unexpected that there would be $100+ million for K-12 in the final budget.
Representative Hannon.
Thank you, Chair Josephson. Mr. Painter, I want to go to the child care grants that's tied up in litigation and understand what that does in our budget. Is that money held there, and if the court settles it after the fiscal year, they still have authorization to spend it? I presume that the state agency is not distributing those grants, awaiting court decisions on action of that bill. So maybe that's the first premise. Is that accurate?
Through the chair, Representative Hannon, the fiscal note to that bill was not funded in FY25, so there were no funds in the FY25 budget to implement it currently.
Okay, never mind. Then I don't have to worry about us holding the money.
But to follow up on this, and I think we've had a conversation about this, or I did with someone. Let's say the legislature didn't correct its purported error, which may or may not have merit. We won't go into that now. The money, courtesy of the governor, is there effective July 1. If on July 2, the Superior Court said, legislature wrong, Representative Eastman right, okay, then the administration would still have $6.1 million, correct? And what would happen to that $6.1 million?
Mr. Chairman, the administration could redirect it to other programs within that same allocation. So they could redirect the $6.1 million to other child care grants that they don't need a statute for. So they could say, you know, since it's, the funds are in the same place, that we want to put it towards what the $7.5 million was last year. They could make that decision at that point because it's all funds in that same allocation. They'd have that flexibility at that point.
So your understanding is the lawsuit wouldn't defeat the appropriation. That's what I'm hearing.
Mr. Chairman, yes, because this is not a contingent appropriation as a fiscal note would have been a year ago. This is just an appropriation as part of the number section.
Got it. Representative Stapp, did you have a question?
Yeah, thank you, Coach Justin, to the chair on this line of subject. Isn't that child care money, isn't that in the under the Department of Health, and don't they have special moving power, so it wouldn't necessarily have to be reappropriated to stay in the child care, can go anywhere in that department because it's under the $10 million threshold of authority through the chair?
Director.
Through the chair, Representative Stapp, yes. They would not be obligated to spend it on that purpose.
Okay. All right. So we're at slide 6, I believe.
So the next few slides kind of break out our agency operations between formula programs and non-formula programs to help understand the growth in the operating budget better. So about half of our budget, of our agency operations general fund budget, is part of formula programs. And those are, the largest are K-12 and Medicaid, where they're driven by a statutory formula or, in the case of Medicaid, kind of a combination of rates that are negotiated with the federal government. And then there are also nearly $200 million in general funds of other formula programs. That includes the Pioneer Home Payment Assistance, the Foster Services Care and Adoption and Guardians Program, where they're providing money to based on a rate for those. people. There's adult public assistance, child care benefits, tribal assistance, and senior benefits. So there's quite a few other formula programs. And formula programs generally are dictated by statute and by rates set out by the departments, often in coordination with the federal government, especially in the case of Medicaid. We have less control on the state level of the dollars through the appropriation process than we do for non-formula programs, because there's some sort of external program. So, or external formula that we're following. You know, as we've seen with Medicaid, for example, there we can, if Medicaid is short-funded, it doesn't necessarily mean the services don't happen. It may mean the billing is just pushed to the following fiscal year. We don't necessarily have the power in the appropriations bill to completely dictate how that formula is spent.
Representative Stapp.
Thank you, Co-Chair Joseph, through the Chair, Director Painter. 54% of the budget non-formulaic funding, that's going to be statutes that we pass or things inside the different RDU components of the division. So my question to you, and hopefully you may know, when is the last time that a department seriously went through an RDU component and attempted to maybe zero-base their budget rather than starting from a baseline through the Chair?
Director.
Through the Chair, Representative Stapp, other than the Mental Health Trust, which does that every year, I'm not aware of a particular time that that's a department has gone through a zero-based exercise.
And follow up, Mr. Co-Chair.
Follow up.
Through the Chair to Director Painter. Has there ever been any reason given why we don't have different RDU components, like an attempt at a zero-base their budget, just so we can verify kind of all things? I realize that the entire budget is probably too large to attempt a zero base in a fiscal year, but I think it would be an interesting exercise if we took different division-level components of a department and had them zero base their expenses through the Chair.
Through the Chair, Representative Stapp, it'd be interesting. I think the concern has often been kind of administrative capacity in the state about, you know, how many analysts are there at OMB in departments. A lot of departments have a couple of budget analysts. It may be difficult to do that level of analysis.
Thanks.
Okay, slide 7.
So we have the K-12 funding here as the largest formula program in terms of general funds, and then some bills, although I did this based on the assumption that the House Rules CS would be what moved forward. I'll note that in a second, the difference based on what the committee actually moved out. So the FY25 budget included about $175 million, as I said, in funding above the foundation formula, which is equivalent to $680 in the base student allocation, plus $7.3 million for the pupil transportation formula. So $182 million last year for K-12 on top of the statutory formula. This year, the governor has two major K-12 bills. We've mostly heard about House Bill 76, which is his education omnibus bill. That has fiscal notes totaling $116 million in FY26, rising to $181 million in FY27. He also has a tribal compacting bill that would have a $17 million fiscal note in FY26 and then $12 million in FY27. So also a significant fiscal note going with that. I think we've heard less about that in the totals, but again, if you're looking at proposals, that's another meaningful one. House Bill 69 is a vehicle in this body for an increase in the base student allocations. The House Education Committee version on the top line would have increased funding in FY26 by about $325 million. The House Rules CS, as introduced, would have increased by $1,000 in the BSA, so that's $253 million. The committee adopted an amendment that would have added some language that adds some language from the governor's bill that gives out additional amounts to schools for reading proficiency incentive grants. That has a $22 million price tag on the fiscal note to the governor's bill. So we should really add about $22 million a year to the price tag of this bill based on what actually came out of rules. You know, just noting on this item, the absent any legislation or outside the formula money, the projected K-12 formula money is projected to go down by about $28.7 million of general funds. And the biggest reason is a lower student count. If you look at the Department of Labor's demographic projections, they show significantly fewer children age 0 through 5 than 6 through 18, about 1,000 fewer per year. So we could expect that we may see student populations continue to decrease, which may, would drive the kind of baseline cost of K-12 down going forward.
Director, you show SB 82 in bullet two. That's the same as HB 76?
Mr. Chairman, yes. So it's okay. SB 82. Yeah, I think I originally put Senate bills because this was the House, Senate version. But
that's fine. And if you didn't say, what was the fiscal note on tribal compacting?
Mr. Chairman, that's the HB 59 / SB 66, $17.5 million and then $12 million in the out years.
So 17 down to 12?
Yes.
So to be clear, it sounds like the governor in total wants to spend, say, by FY27, approaching $200 million. And what the Rules Committee advanced today is closer to about $275 million. They're both expensive.
Mr. Chairman, that's correct. And, you know, when the governor had given his press conference announcing the budget, he said, I'm coming out with K-12 bills that will total about $200 million, and that's where he got to.
Okay. All right. Representative Tomaszewski.
Thank you, Co-Chair Josephson, through the chair. Thank you, Director Painter, for being here. You mentioned loss of funding due to fewer students being enrolled. What is the average dollar amount per student that the state of Alaska pays?
Through the chair, Representative Tomaszewski. So the BSA is, you know, 5,960, but then when it goes through the multiplier, I think we end up at something like, on average, $12,000 a student, a little higher than that, $12,000, $13,000. So each student is something in that range. I'd have to check on the math, and I can get back to the committee with better math than what I can do in my head.
Follow up. Thank you. So, but total spending, I mean, the BSA isn't total spending for schools. We have other ways that we fund schools. Do you know just ballpark figure, what do we spend per student?
Through the chair, Representative Tomaszewski, I don't off the top of my head. I apologize. I can get back to the committee with that.
Okay, thank you.
Representative Staff, did you have a question? Okay. Slide 8.
So the next couple of slides dig in a little bit to K-12, some drivers of the costs here. So one thing I think is notable is that sometimes you see people here in the Capitol talk about either the base student allocation only or total funding only. Both of those kind of don't completely hit the mark in terms of what we're seeing in district finances, and perhaps it's part of why people talk past each other. But one of the things we've seen over the past decade, this goes back to FY11, so the past 15 years, I suppose, is that the total number of students has gone down a little bit, but there's also been a significant shift towards correspondence students and away from brick-and-mortar students. So if you look at FY17, that was kind of total 130,000 students. That was our most recent kind of peak year in terms of total number of students. If you look at the total ADM between FY17 and the projection for FY26, it's down about 4.3%, or about 5,600 students. If you look at the correspondence ADM during that point, ADM is average daily membership. That's gone up from about 12,000 to 22,000. So, you know, over 10,000 more correspondence students now, or an 86% increase. But the non-correspondence ADM, or brick and mortar, has gone down by 16,000 students, or nearly 14%. So those non-correspondence, or those correspondence students, receive less funding. They get 0.9 of an ADM and don't go through the multipliers. So they get significantly less funding than a non-correspondence student. And so if you look at the total dollars, they've gone down on a per-student basis, in part because of the shift. But if you're a district, you're also seeing lower costs due to that to some extent, because correspondence students are cheaper than in-person students. And so you're both seeing total dollars go down and potentially a cost differential. But, of course, then you see on the other side that some districts have cost issues relating to the shrinking student population in terms of having schools having to consolidate because you have fewer students. Some districts are too small to be able to consolidate, so you end up with just empty classroom space. You don't necessarily see a lot of savings from that. And so there's not really a lot of uniformity here, but looking at just total dollars can be a little misleading because of the change in our student makeup over the past decade.
Okay. Slide 9.
So slide 9, gets into why just the base student allocation is also kind of missing part of the point. So this essentially is trying to show how the multipliers have changed over time. And so each layer on this graph represents the impact on the adjusted average daily membership of each adjustment on each student. So we start with, in blue, the impact, the amount of one student, and then add the various adjustments. Not all of them are multipliers. I've kind of, you know, shifted them into being multipliers here. So the school size multiplier, cost factors, special needs factor, career technical education factor, and then the special education intensives. And so there were some changes in the formula, but there really haven't been any changes in the formula since FY15. There were, leading up to that, there were significant changes. But what this means is that a dollar in the BSA in FY11 became $1.96 in terms of what goes to districts. Today in FY26, a dollar in the BSA means $2.28 per student. So significantly greater impact of a single dollar in the BSA now. One of the real drivers of that is the count of the special education intensive students. That's increased over the last decade by over a third, so by 10,000. Since those students are counted as 13 times the BSA, that means that there's a significant impact of that on total funding. But not only does that, again, increase funding, that changes the cost structure for districts, because there's certain obligations that that comes along with in terms of how they actually provide services to students. So again, if you look at just the BSA, you're kind of missing that they are getting more money, but then if you look at just total dollars, you're missing that they also have higher costs. So again, I'm perhaps not helping the conversation other than to complicate a little bit that part of the reason I think it's so difficult to wrestle with this issue is that you can see changes on both the cost and the cost side for the state and cost side for districts.
Okay. And it helps respond to Representative Tomaszewski's question as well. Representative Stapp and then Allard.
Yeah, thank Co-Chair Justin through the chair to Director Painter. I think there's some really interesting correlations happening in this chart and the last chart, Director. One of the things that I noticed right off the bat is when the non-correspondence ADM count goes down, the school size multiplier funding goes up. So in my mind, kids are not in school, therefore an empty school is now more worth more money to districts than a full school is because of the multiplier. And my question to you through the chair would be, why on earth would we want to incentivize more schools with less people in them?
Director.
Through the chair, Representative Stapp, one of the reasons you see that, especially in FY21, is the hold harmless provision. So there's a hold harmless provision that says that if you lose more than 5% of your in-person student count, you can phase that in over the course of several years. What happened particularly in FY21 is there was a whole lot of students during the COVID pandemic who switched over. That triggered the hold harmless provision in many districts. And so on a per-student basis, they saw a spike in funding. In fact, in total funding, they saw a spike because some districts got the hold harmless funding for a student and then also counted them as a correspondence student, so they were able to get double the funding in those cases. Mostly that was confined to FY21. But I would note that in FY26, 18 districts are under the hold harmless provision because of having lost 5% within the last few years. So many districts are losing population, and they retain some of their funding for a few years based on that hold harmless provision.
Fault, Mr. Coacher.
Follow-up?
Yeah, thank you, Coacher Joseph, to Director Painter. No, I'm aware of the hold harmless. I'm trying to think of the financial impacts, because the hold harmless has a period of time in which it runs out, and if a school district is not prepared, they could face really a cliff in funding when the hold harmless is gone. But I am curious, if you could maybe articulate to me, what is the logic behind utilizing a multiplier like school size? Through the chair.
Director.
Through the chair, Representative Stapp. The reason that was put in the formula back in 1998 essentially has to do with economies of scale. You know, there's certain fixed costs of running a building, and those scale up to some degree with the size of that, but not necessarily just one-to-one with the student count. You know, there's going to be some fixed costs that are the first student in a building is going to be the most expensive. The 1,001 student, that added marginal student is not going to have a big increase in your facilities costs. So that and that's the idea that it's that's supposed to account for. I think when that was designed, we didn't have as many shrinking communities, and when kind of the extent of that became clear, the legislature did adopt a few years ago a school consolidation hold harmless as well. That's separate from this and not really on this graph, but if to try to encourage districts to consolidate without losing funding for at least a few years, that's a 4-year hold harmless that phases in. The idea that, you know, just the legislature, when they adopted that bill, understood that, yes, districts may want to keep schools open because they get the school size factor, but it would save money overall to close them. So we'll have this hold harmless for the school consolidation to help encourage districts to close the schools. And that was if they need to. That was the intent of that bill. So it was recognizing that factor.
Okay. Representative Allard.
Thank you, Co-Chair. And through the Chair, Director Painter, you hit on the next slide, which was SPED. And I was trying to figure this one out. So if I've had quite a few people email me after we spoke to DEED. My question is, if we spend a certain amount on SPED based on the formula, and it's supposed to go to an individual child, is it reported or possible that not all those funds are actually spent on that child and can be used in other areas of that school district or that particular school or however the school district wants to spend it?
Director?
Through the Chair, Representative Allard, we're going to be leaving the area where I can speak confidently. I know that there are certain requirements for services that must be provided. I'm not sure the extent of the reporting that's required. I can check with the Department of Education and get back about exactly how that works. I would say that the way the system works right now, there's a special needs factor that's 20% that's kind of a block grant, and then there's the special education intensives. There's nothing that really, other than for intensives, there's nothing that scales up for students who may need extra help but not the full intensive. And so it's sort of an all or nothing. Either you get 13 times extra for that student or you get no extra for that student. And so it's not necessarily that, you know, there may be students who, you know, fall into one of those categories that they need some extra help, but they, because the special needs factor is just a block grant, the district has no extra money for those unless they're an intensive, right? And that's one of the, I think, challenges of our current formula.
Okay. May I just do a quick follow-up
yes.
for clarification?
Follow-up, Representative Allard.
Okay, so when I'm receiving information from people within the school district, and you said you could follow up with DEED and get back with us on it, I guess my flat question is, and I think you answered it, but I'm not completely satisfied, and I think that's why you were going to do the follow-up, is that at a certain level, is there, for the intensive needs, money left over that the school can reallocate in somewhere else that they believe or is needed, and is there a way we could track that, or and why isn't it maybe perhaps not given back? But if we could track where those dollars are spent, that would be great. If I'm clear,
yeah.
Is
yes.
it? Okay, thank you, Chair, I appreciate it.
I'll follow up with the department and get back to the committee.
Representative Galvin.
Through the chair. This is back to slide 8. And I just wanted to make a note and then ask you about this, that when I'm looking at February 26 DEED's report, I'm looking at the brick-and-mortar preliminary number of ADN, and they're at 103,110 with the projected number to be 101,840. So that is a change of 1.2% downward trend of brick and mortar. Of correspondent students, the preliminary number for 2025 is 23620. The projected number is 22840. So that is a change of 3.3%. So it's almost three times as many losses on correspondence as opposed to brick-and-mortar students.
That is, so it's a kind of an unusual trend now. Maybe some are coming back. We don't really know what that's about, but I just wanted to make note of that. And particularly in highlight, what I don't know is how we could look at this given intensive needs, because it's hard to know the high intensive need students, you know, who's moving where, because it seems to me that that's kind of critical in terms of overall expenses. And I don't know if you have any commentary on that, but I do want to make sure that we put on record that we note that this trend is slightly changing a little bit more than what we've just heard.
All right, so we'll go to slide 10.
Okay, Mr. Chairman, so you heard a lot in this committee about Medicaid recently, so I won't go over it too much, but you know, some of the things, I think I'll end up reiterating what Dr. Helvoid, I suppose, testified to this committee that from FY15 through 18, Medicaid spending declined. A lot of that was due to Medicaid reform efforts and to like tribal reclaiming and efforts to hold the rate structure down at the time. Due to a temporarily higher FMAP, which is the Federal Medical Assistance Percentage, and reduced utilization during the COVID pandemic, we actually saw spending go down significantly in FY20 and 21 and has started to go back upwards as that enhanced FMAP has gone away and utilization has gone back to normal. So based on, you know, the numbers in the governor's amended budget, in FY26, the projection that's in the governor's amended budget is a full $134 million or 22% higher than FY23. So the last few years we kind of returned to this growth trend. And, you know, the MESA report that we just got indicates that we should see that exceeding inflation going forward. So their projection is, I believe, 4.4% for general funds. If that's right, maybe it's 4.7. I don't remember which one was which. But, you know, significantly faster than inflation growth for Medicaid going forward. So that's something that to watch as a cost driver, which we've been fortunate over the past decade or so, it hasn't been much of a cost driver. We've actually, you know, only recently exceeded the level from FY15, but now we're kind of getting back to where that may be an upward cost driver again.
Yes, Dr. Helvoid praised us, but I see that we're inching upward. All right. Slide 11.
Mr. Chairman, the next slide covers non-formula agency operations. So we saw significant reductions from FY15 through FY18, going from about $2.3 billion down to about $1.8 billion, so nearly $500 million of reductions in non-formula agency operations over that period. Since FY22, we had kind of a flat period for a little bit, and then since FY22, we've seen an upward trend once again. So going to FY22 as our baseline, non-formula agency ops have gone up by about $500 million or 26%. That's an average annual growth rate of 5.9%. Inflation has also been high over that period. It's a cumulative 18%, but it's been higher than inflation. And some of the reason is because of we were able to hold it flat for a while. You know, it's sort of, I think some people call it isostatic rebound, or, you know, use whatever kind of metaphor you want. One would be, you know, you can skip going to the dentist, but eventually you have to deal with those cavities that you get. Some of the cost belt tightening efforts that kept our agency operations going down and flat, eventually there's going to be some upward pressure again on things like health insurance costs, employee pay, commodities and services costs, and there has been some program expansion. Some of that has been adding things back that have been cut, and some have been adding in different places. We also had temporary COVID funds that were able to offset some general fund expenditures. A lot of that has gone away. For example, there were COVID funds that in the Department of Transportation that significantly reduced the UGF cost of airports for a number of years, and that's gone away at this point. Then, you know, one of the big variables that's out there is the statewide salary survey that is expected to be released in the next few weeks. Just to give you an idea of the scale, the UGF funding for the executive branch salaries total is about $661 million, and that's just salaries, not all personal services. So if you're just increasing salaries across the board, each 1% would be $6.6 million. So, you know, you've heard numbers about what the salary study could mean, salary survey could mean, that may give you an idea of the scale in terms of our budget if at any given percentage. And, of course, the salary study may not have across the board that may be more targeted. We have no idea because it's not public yet.
Director, I saw that the governor's FY26 budget, this is pre-amendment, was a 1.3% growth in agency spend. So how is it that the rate over the last several years has been around 5.9%? Are there big ticket items that jump out at you that we've spent money on?
Mr. Chairman, that number that the governor has includes formula programs. And when you have K-12, where the governor's budget has nothing compared to the outside of the formula funding of $175 million, that's going to suppress your apparent growth. So if you look at just the non, and that's why I wanted to separate out the non-formula items so you can really just see that in terms of non-formula items, we've seen a pretty steady march upwards over the past 4 years.
And you said that 18% of it arguably reflects inflation. The other 7 is sort of on us.
Mr. Chairman, again, you could, you know, some of it, if you look at what's coming in bargaining contracts, some of them are making up for lost inflation that they didn't get. For example, a few years ago, we saw a Public Safety Employees Association contract that had 10% raises. Inflation at that point had not been 10%. What that reflected is they hadn't gotten raises for a couple of years before that. So sometimes you'll see a flat trend, and then it comes back with a higher-than-inflation catch-up provision later. And we see that certainly in employee salaries.
Okay, let's go to slide 12.
The next item on here is statewide items. So those are the things that don't really fit into agency budgets but are still operating items. One of the largest, or I think the largest, is statewide assistance to retirement. That's what the state pays on behalf of school districts and municipalities because we cap their contributions for the public employees' retirement system and the teachers' retirement system. And the ARM board projects that number will increase from $220 million in FY26 to $284 million in FY27, so a $64 million increase. That's what we use for the projections at this point. I think in reality, the FY27 number will be lower. So here's your good news of the day. Because the June 30, 2024 valuation was more favorable than the June 30, 2023 valuation. So when that's adopted for FY27, we should see a lower number than the 284 that you see reflected here. But when we get into the sort of scenarios, that's built into the scenario is the 284 because that's the adopted rate at this point. State debt payments are expected to stay flat for the general obligation bonds. We start to see some of those fall off in a few years, but not within this 3-year time frame. School debt reimbursement is projected to go down year by year, and it has been for the last few years because of the moratorium on that debt. That moratorium is gone now for a decade. It's scheduled to end on July 1st of this year. That when it resumes, we should see, or when debt is able to be taken again, we may see some amounts added. We've had an assumption in Ledge Finance that it'll resume at exactly the same rate of debt before the moratorium a decade ago, but at the new prorated amount. So it used to be a 60 or 70% reimbursement, now it's 40 or 50. So in the absence of better information, we just assume the old trend continues. I would say realistically, there's reasons to think it could be a lot higher because there's kind of a backlog of need because they haven't had the ability to get state assistance for the last decade on new debt. You could also see an argument for why it could be lower because during this decade, the state has not always paid its share. There have been several vetoes to that. The legislature actually made up that amount in kind of a lump sum in FY22, but there were several years that some municipalities had to raise property taxes because of those vetoes. So there may be municipalities or voters that are a little hesitant to trust the state again. So I could see an argument for it being lower than it was before that history of vetoes. I could see an argument for being higher. As it is, we're going with the 7.8 as a placeholder, but who knows? It's a big question mark.
I'm curious if you know, Director, for example, take a high school in Seattle. If it has, presumably the city can have bonded indebtedness, would King County also afford some revenue to the Seattle City Schools? I mean, I'm just trying to get a sense. We don't have that sort of local government structure. So this falls on the state and sometimes the cities. Does that explain some of this?
Mr. Chairman, that's part of it. I don't know the structures in other states very well. I don't want to speak about that without...
Representative Bynum?
Thank you, Co-Chair Justice, and through the chair. You talked a little bit about this outstanding debt that's out there and making a base assumption. And from my perspective of seeing what I think I see going throughout the state, and we're talking about long-term capital reinvestment, that's been one of the things I've been asking quite a bit about. My speculation is that we just have a bigger backlog of deferred maintenance, and that what we're going to see is that these facilities aren't being planned for. And I fear that we're going to see a lot more potential debt out there in the future because of the aging of our facilities. Where are you specifically getting your information from when you're talking about trying to make an accurate projection of what this school bond debt reimbursement may look like into the future?
Through the chair, Representative Bynum. So the $7.8 million came from asking the Department of Education what's the history of new school debt for the decade prior to the moratorium, and then just taking an average of that. I mean, it was not a sophisticated number that we've been using, kind of intentionally, because we don't think we have a basis for a good number. The Department of Education does have a publication where they look at, and I don't remember the name of it, but it's on their website somewhere, where they have an idea. They have a number for the value of school facilities and what a 3% replacement or 3% of that replacement cost would be for ongoing costs to maintain them. They do have a publication that discusses that, but we have not used that to try to develop a number because it's really hard to predict what local governments would do given the backlog. But there is more information that the Department of Education has, and I can send that report to the committee if that's helpful.
Thank you. I appreciate that.
Okay. Slide 13.
So onto the state's deferred maintenance backlog. So in FY25, according to data from the Office of Management and Budget, the state had a $2.4 billion deferred maintenance backlog. The University of Alaska accounts for about 63% of that, or $1.5 billion. Some of that is because they have a large square footage of buildings. Some of it is also that they have more rigorous standards for tracking. To give an example of that, the last version of this we had was from FY23, and it showed that for the public building fund, those are what the DOT commissioner spoke about in front of this committee a couple of weeks ago. These are buildings that were for which the state pays into kind of a pool to use for deferred maintenance. So 2 years ago, they estimated $81 million of deferred maintenance for that. Then they did a complete facilities inspection and said, okay, what's the true number? And it's $211 million. So it went up, you know, more than doubled once they did that inspection. And so when we see that the state as a whole accounts for a lot less than the university, some of that really is just that a lot of it is not tracked as rigorously, which I think the committee discussed with DOT, you know, pretty extensively, so I won't rehash that. If you want to try to figure out how much should we be spending on maintenance, we've often said, well, if you take our $9 billion asset value of state-owned facilities and then we spend 2%, that'd be $180 million. But that'd be, you know, the sort of 2 to 6% guidelines what you spend in ongoing maintenance. That doesn't really speak to a deferred maintenance backlog. When you have a $2.4 billion backlog, it's unclear if just spending more on regular maintenance would necessarily get you caught up. There was a five-year period from FY10 through FY14 when the legislature and administration had a deferred maintenance program where they would spend $100 million a year on deferred maintenance, and that was the one time we've seen the backlog actually get smaller. So it is possible that, you know, $100 million at least a decade ago was enough to shrink the backlog a little bit. As soon as that $100 million a year went away, the backlog started to go back up. The governor's budget this year has combined $26 million for deferred maintenance in state facilities. There may be – the university sometimes uses some of its operating money, but they don't have any money in the capital budget for it. That $26 million and sort of this idea of basing our amount on our asset value, it doesn't really account for everything that the legislature may want to consider in figuring out how much we should fund for on our capital appropriations. It doesn't account for the need to replace aging specialized facilities. So you see, we have office buildings. To some extent, you can keep an office building going for a long time through maintenance. Some of the specialized facilities, like Pioneer Homes and prisons, you can't necessarily just keep maintaining that same facility, or you hit a point of no return where you need to replace a facility. Some of those are not necessarily reflected when you just look at these percentages, and you may need to handle that through bonding because they're too large to handle through the regular capital budget process. These numbers also don't account for line of business technology systems. You know, we don't place a monetary value on the state's accounting system, so that's not included in the $9 billion. But the governor's budget this year has nearly $20 million for IT projects because that's a significant need, is to replace these IT systems over time. And again, it doesn't account for school construction major maintenance because that's not state-owned facilities, or at least they're not counted there, even if the state technically owns them in some cases. That's handled through the school debt reimbursement program and the REAA fund that spend on rural maintenance, but is not really reflected in these overall totals as well.
Okay. Slide 14.
Slide 14 shows the deferred maintenance backlog by agency, omitting the university, so you can see the others. You can see that the largest chunk is the Department of Transportation and Public Facilities. That's because they manage, as the public facility side, they manage the a lot of buildings on behalf of other agencies. The next largest you see are natural resources, a lot of park facilities in particular, which are often very small and remote. So you may see small projects, but there are a lot of them and they're remote. Department of Corrections, which operates a number of multi-decade-old prisons, and then Department of Family Community Services and Community Services, which has Pioneer Homes and juvenile justice facilities that can be rather expensive to maintain as well.
Okay. Slide 15.
So slide 15 gets us on to talking about federal funding on the operating budget side. So federal funding outlook is rather uncertain, let's say, for programs like Medicaid and due to proposed budgetary changes by Congress. So the Federal House of Representatives passed a reconciliation budget that directs I believe, Energy and Commerce Committee to make $880 billion of cuts to the programs under their purview, which include Medicaid and the SNAP program, Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, over the next decade. There's kind of a list that you can see of potential things they could go to hit those numbers, and a lot of those are hard to quantify. The one that we can quantify is the one that I'll end up talking about, but there's a lot that could have impacts. The one we can quantify is the idea of changing the FMAP rate for Medicaid expansion. Right now, in FY24, the department estimates that the UGF cost for the Medicaid expansion population is about $50 million. So changing that rate from 90% to the state's regular FMAP rate of 51.54%, I believe, would cost about $250 million. So that's the one thing we could maybe quantify. There's been discussions about phasing in a reduction to that FMAP. There's been a lot of other discussions about changes to Medicaid that are very difficult to quantify, like work requirements or per capita coverage caps. Again, very difficult to quantify that. I can't begin to know how that would impact our Medicaid budget. So I guess that's just to say it's uncertain exactly the impact, but we are quite dependent on the federal government revenue to pay for our current budget. Another one I'll flag that's not necessarily current items but just built into our budget is the Alaska Marine Highway System. The operating budget for the Marine Highway System includes $76.5 million of federal funding that was part of a five-year program under IJA, the infrastructure bill, that provided $1 billion over a five-year span for the Marine Highway System. We're in year four of that. So in FY28, the third year on our three-year outlook, there's no funding for that. We will have to make up that $76.5 million from somewhere. When we first were beginning to get this federal money, I think there was some expectation that we would be able to save up a balance in the Marine Highway Fund. That has not come to pass. We've been spending the Marine Highway Fund in both the operating and capital budgets, and the department has projected that based on the governor's budget, they're actually going to be about $8 million in the hole in the Marine Highway system in FY26. So we don't have extra money to kind of wean us off the federal money. It's kind of the opposite there. So if there's no extension to that program, we could see, you know, a sudden $76.5 million hole in the operating budget where those federal funds used to be.
Representative Bynum, then Johnson, and then Stapp.
Thank you,
Representative Bynum.
Thank
Representative
you, Chair Justin, and through the chair. I hate to go backwards just real quick. I just wanted to clarify something on the talking about the assets. You put on the slide here, the third bullet point down, that we have an estimated $9 billion of asset value. You're making an indication that that was of 2022. My assumption is that asset value is determined based on when the actual asset was put into place. So if we're talking about a facility, for example, that was put in place in 1970, that we're assuming the asset value from 1970. These are not inflated or escalated values based on the initial investment, are they?
Through the chair, Representative Bynum, I actually do not know the answer to that. That number came from the Office of Management and Budget, and I can ask them about how they come up with that number and get back to you.
Thank you. And then as a quick follow-up.
Follow-up.
So you listed many things that are not included on that list of what we have as backlog or assumptions of this 2% for value. As far as Department of Transportation go, are highways included in that value, or is that something that is not included?
Through the chair, Representative Bynum, I don't believe they're included. And generally, highways themselves are not included in sort of our deferred maintenance backlog because that's handled through sure. the federal funding. DOT does include things like the maintenance stations and the, you know, repair the sheds and things like that that are state funded.
Sure.
In their value.
Okay. And then as one quick other final
yep,
follow-up. So we know that the we're talking about the roads, whether they're state highways or state obligated roadways, those aren't included per se. Again, I'm going to assume that that includes bridges, things like that. Those are not included. Do we take into consideration when do we look at or take into consideration when we have federal grant money and or state grant money going in for facilities into communities? Do we take any kind of consideration of what that value is and the needs for long-term capital replacement of those facilities, or is that fall upon the shoulders of those communities that are receiving those dollars?
Through the chair, Representative Bynum, in the Executive Budget Act, there is a provision that indicates that information should be provided. I can't guarantee that it always is.
Thank you.
Representative Stapp.
thank you, Co-Chair Justin, through the chair to Director Painter. So a couple of things here. First thing regarding just quick clarification, the congressional budget they passed said a number, but it didn't identify where the cuts were supposed to come from specifically. Is that correct?
Through the chair, Representative Stapp. Yes, it didn't specify how the reductions would happen, or there's a range of federal programs that they could fall on.
Yep, thank you for that follow-up, Mr.
Coach.
Yep, follow-up. Very standard politician thing to do, say something and then not identify, I suppose. But through the chair to Director Painter, I remember the public debate when the previous governor expanded Medicaid and the legislature disapproved of doing that adamantly at the time. And I want to say the main reason was they did not believe that the FMAP, which used to be 100% and stepped the state down to 90%, that the federal government would maintain that level of funding in perpetuity because the Congressional Budget Office basically said that it would balloon the federal deficit out. So I'm curious if we were to see a reduction in the FMAP percentage, do we have any numbers yet from the Legislative Financial Division that would tell us kind of what that number would be if it were an 80% cost share or 70% cost share, like kind of how we do the oil price per dollar through the chair?
Through the chair, Representative Stapp, we can kind of use that, I think it's about $53 million cost that we have in FY24 and just scale that because we know that's at a 90%. And you can scale that. So if you know you go to an 80%, that doubles, so about $53 million. Talking to the department, it's very difficult to get anything more recent than FY24, right? So we don't know necessarily what the Medicaid expansion would be right now in FY25 or projected for 26, but that's the number they feel confident in, is that FY24 number. So you can sort of scale that up and down.
And one more follow-up, Mr. Butcher. Through the chair to Director Painter. Changing gears here to the Alaska Marine Highway System. I know that since I've been in the building, the plan was, like you had mentioned, we're going to kind of bank that federal money. That's not happening. So what would our liability for AMHS be in the event that those funds ultimately expire, which they will shortly, through the chair?
Through the chair, Representative Staff. So on the operating side, it'd be $76.5 million that we'd have to replace. On the capital side, it's a little harder to say because it depends on what we plan to do going forward in terms of constructing vessels. Right now, a lot of the capital money is going to the Tustamina replacement. That will be completely funded this year. So what will be funded next year? Will it be the next mainliner? Will they have enough to do the full, or where will that money come from after that? That's kind of a broader question, but on the operating side, it's $76.5 million.
Thanks.
Okay, slide 16.
Mr. Chairman, the next slide goes on to the capital budget, federal funding outlook. So, again, this is rather uncertain. So the Alaska Energy Authority's Grid Resilience and Innovation Partnership, or GRIP 1, we received the grant for GRIP 1. We did not receive the grant for GRIP 2. We received a large award from that a couple of years ago. It requires, we put some state match into it. We'll require another $143 million over the next few years, FY27 through 32. That doesn't necessarily have to be made up by the state. If the state doesn't provide the funds, it could be passed on to local ratepayers. And the governor's budget in FY26 has $1.5 million. Based on the project timing, that number would need to go up over time in certain years, so when there's sort of larger needs. But this year, it's a relatively small part of our budget. So it's, again, something to keep an eye out for in the future that, you know, if you spread it out evenly from 27 through 32, it would be $24 million a year or so. But, again, that could be the actual ask won't be even each year as they need money. Or it could be financed another way by ratepayers if the state doesn't ultimately pay. And then worth noting also that the federal funds for that are currently frozen. So even, you know, we may lose a season depending on how long those are frozen, if they get unfrozen. And I'm not sure what that will do to the cash flow of the project going forward. Broadly, the Infrastructure Investment and Jobs Act, or the Infrastructure Bill, IIJA, increased capital funds available for several programs, particularly DOT's Highways and Aviation's, the AEA's renewable energy projects. A lot of those are currently frozen. And then DEC's Village Safe Water Program. It's not necessarily clear when that expires whether these higher amounts will continue or not. To some extent, these higher amounts for the DOT amounts have not even kept up with project inflation. So if you look at with the highways, we're getting roughly 20% more than we were before IIJA, but projects are more than 20% more expensive than they were before the pandemic. So we're not even ahead in terms of the actual projects we're able to do of where we were before this. So should we expect that going forward, when IIJA is up, we'll see a new infrastructure bill with more money or less? It's hard to say. It's just an uncertainty. And the same for the other items like Village Safe Water. It's unclear if that's going to continue at the higher rate we've seen the last few years or go back to a lower rate. It's very difficult to project what the federal government will be doing a couple of years from now.
Director, on the first item on slide 16, what does the budget have in it for GRIP funding? For FY26?
Mr. Chairman, $1.5 million is what's in the governor's budget.
And you explained that it's not an even amortization or whatever, but funding only $1.5 million means this $23.8 million will go up.
Mr. Chairman, the $23.8 million is factoring in just the $1.5 million this year, so that'd be the average from 27 through 32. But again, you know, looking at what AEA has said in terms of their cash flow, there's going to be some years they need 60, some years they need 10, you know. But yeah.
Okay. Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, to the Director Painter. I thought that I asked DCCED about the the GRIP funding and ask if that had been paused. And just, was it yesterday? They said that it hadn't been. So I had heard that it had been paused. And of course, I know there's a couple different projects out there, but that are all under this Department of Energy grants. So anyway, but according to them, they said that it wasn't. So I don't know if you could clarify that.
Through the chair, Representative Johnson, I'll check with them. I'm going off of what was reported in the media, which said there was pause. So perhaps it was misreported. That would not be the first time.
Representative Stapp.
Thank you, Chair Justin. To the chair, Director Painter. perhaps you can remember, Director, I remember the chart from last year, and I want to say that the FY26 appropriation was supposed to be much larger than $1.5 million. That's kind of how that spread out. I am a little, I guess, perturbed that we would enter into something that we want done and then basically put a future legislature and really a future governor on the hook with funding the bulk of it, especially when our revenue projections are not as rosy in the next couple of years. So I know that if we did appropriate the money, it would basically just sit there until it was utilized. But I'm just curious, I guess my question is, if we do another $1.5 million the next year, what is that future liability that we're hooking someone go up to through the chair?
Director.
Through the chair, Representative Stapp, I'm not going to try to do the math in my head, but it would go up. And I'm not sure, looking at the cash flow, when the large need for cash flow is. I think this year it's particularly low, but going forward this would be an unusually low year. But because they have a bonding ability that they're to use some bonding authority they already had for part of it. But I'd have to get back to you on what would – I'm not going to try to do the mental math of what would happen if you did another $1.5 million next year.
Co-Chair Shragi, then Representative Hannon.
Thank you, Chair Josephson. I mean, if we did $1.5 million this year and $1.5 million next, it's essentially $140 million in state match that's still required for a future legislatures and administrations. I mean, is that – whatever we pay now brings down that total amount that is ultimately needed to be made up for in future legislatures, correct?
Through the Chair, Representative Shragi, yes, to the extent that – it's not shifted to ratepayers in some way, yes.
Representative Hannon.
Thank you, Co-Chair Josephson. Mr. Painter, remind me, how much did we finally, how much ended up getting all the way through in the veto process for the GRIP project in FY25?
Through the Chair, Representative Hannon, I'll have to get back to you with that number because it was split between the supplemental and FY25, and I don't want to try to remember the exact numbers we ended up because it was two different appropriations and multiple rounds. So
it, 13 and 30, and then it was both were cut. And,
right.
Okay.
Yeah, I'll have to get back.
I'm recalling, Director, that the GRIP award came with, I remember the number 206. Was that what we were awarded if we matched the 206?
Mr. Chairman, yes. It was $206 million and matched dollar for dollar.
So sort of, it would be odd to apply for it, win it, get this generous grant, and then not try to match it, maybe? It's a policy call, I realize.
Mr. Chairman, I mean, yes, the legislature last year did appropriate the entire federal award and then only a portion of the general fund, so
yeah,
the expectation would be financed in the future.
Okay, slide 17.
So the next slide shows some of the long-term state needs, and a lot of this is kind of rolling up things we've been talking about the last few slides in terms of the deferred maintenance, school major maintenance, and school construction. These are the lists that the Department of Education has. There's also other lists that are out there for state needs that there's kind of a year-by-year list, the Harbor Matching Grant Fund, the Renewable Energy Fund. And then there's a couple of programs, the bulk fuel program and then the rural power system upgrades where there's priority lists. The top 25 projects for those are, pretty large, and the amount in the governor's budget is, not quite enough to get through that very quickly. We're basically matching the federal funds that are available for both those two programs. And then another one that's not on the capital side is the pension past service liability. We talked about that, where we have a past service liability on the pension systems that we'll be amortizing through 2039. So again, as we're kind of looking at our long-term needs, I think the intent here is to just lay some of those out, how we're paying for those over the next few years.
Okay. Slide. Representative Shragi, Co-Chair Shragi.
Yeah, thank you, Chair Josephson. I'm wondering on this slide at a high level, to what extent this list is vulnerable to the cost of inflation and escalating costs due to that, and then to what extent that inflationary factor is built into these costs today.
Through the Chair, Representative Shragi, I think with pension past service liability, that's built in. For the others, they're generally not built in. So the deferred maintenance backlog, if we paid for it all right now, it would be $2.4 billion, you know, assuming we could somehow do that. If we don't fund it, it'll just go up. And that's both inflation and things deteriorate, right? So what starts out as a small project, if you don't fund it for 5 years, becomes a bigger project. So you can see both of those where the same project may be more expensive on a future deferred maintenance list.
Follow up?
To put a finer point on it, we expect that these are the costs today. They have included the last few years of inflation when we look at these numbers. Is that accurate?
Through the chair, Representative Shragi, to some extent, although, again, with deferred maintenance, I think the amount understates the true need there because, you know, using the Pioneer Homes as an example, you know, the full deferred maintenance list for the whole department is 40-something million, and we know the cost of replacing a single Pioneer Home is multiple times that. So if you look at the actual cost to deal with all these things, it may far exceed the deferred maintenance backlog.
Okay. Slide 18.
So, Mr. Chairman, this presentation is, I guess, the three-year plan, but, you know, I'm sort of calling it almost the four-year thing because we're including FY25. We also have to deal with that. We're not through with it yet. So in FY25, before supplementals, we have an $81.5 million deficit based on the fall forecast. Prices have been a little bit above the average so far, but I would be surprised if the spring forecast shows that we have a balanced budget in FY25. It may slightly reduce that deficit, but probably won't be a huge amount. The governor's UGF supplementals so far total $84.2 million. That's actually down from the number the last time I was in front of this committee because the governor removed a $50 million UGF supplemental from his list. There may be additional supplemental amendments. One example is judgments and settlements often keep trickling in as they reach settlements. So when we get the next amendment package, which I believe is on March 14th, we may see more supplementals. So we don't know that we're stuck with that 84.2 as the final number. So combined, that's a $165 million deficit in FY25 that the legislature needs to address. And the reason you have to address it is because last year's legislature did not address it. The last year's legislature did not have any deficit-filling language for FY25. The governor proposes filling an FY25 deficit from the Constitutional Budget Reserve. That requires a three-quarters vote of the legislature.
And alternatives to that, Director, are very, very limited and controversial for sure.
Mr. Chairman, yes. I mean, we could pull out of other accounts. We could pull out of the permanent fund or the higher education fund or the power cost equalization fund or something like that. Those aren't necessarily easy options for sure.
Right. So the governor's choice is arguably the easiest choice without impacting existing capitalized funds.
Right. It's the easiest financially, politically. Yeah. I'll leave that to you, Judge.
Representative Hannon.
Thank you, Co-Chair Josephson. Mr. Painter, what are the legal parameters of the timeline in which we would have to fill this FY25 deficit? Could it literally be done on June 30th?
Through the Chair, Representative Hannon, yes. But the one of the parameters is that the governor has supplemental requests in part because some of these things he would like to have happen sooner than June 30th. So, for example, capitalizing the disaster relief fund. I think, you know, the governor has something like $29 million of appropriations into that fund in FY 25 because it's that fund is currently negative, and they're borrowing from the deferred maintenance appropriation to try to get through the cost of disasters. You could wait to June 30th to deal with that, but I think the governor, by putting in a fast-track supplemental, is indicating some urgency that he would like it dealt with before then. And the governor cannot constitutionally sign an unbalanced budget, so if you gave him a supplemental from the general fund without paying for it, constitutionally, legislative legal has indicated he couldn't sign that. So that's kind of a parameter, is if you want agencies to have money before June 30th, you need to deal with this deficit problem before June 30th.
Follow up?
And Mr. Co-Chair, I want to assure you I'm not advocating for June 30th. Theoretically, we could pass the FY26 and balance it before we dealt with the FY25 deficit.
Through the chair, Representative Hinn, yes. Although, again, one of the longer you push it, there'd be questions about should the governor be invoking impoundment at that point, assuming the legislature is not going to act. Right? You'd get into some interesting legal territory with that for sure.
And I feel like I'm planting the new garden before I've raked the leaves from the previous year. Representative Stapp, did you have a question?
Thank you, Co-Chair Justin, through the chair to Director Painter. You started to talk about what I wanted to talk about. So can you maybe tell us what impoundment does and what it is and when the governor can use it through the chair?
Through the chair, Representative Stapp. So if the legislature... Generally, I'm not sure that there's a lot of Supreme Court cases that give very clear guidance on this, but if the legislature leaves an unbalanced budget, the governor, as the executive branch, has to figure out a way to pay the bills. And so the governor can impound appropriations, which would mean withhold appropriations to try to get through the year. Generally, I don't believe that governors would do that while the legislature is still in session and trying to get through the budget process, but you may come to a point, if we were just sitting there on June 30th, where the governor wouldn't have no options, so he would have to act. And I'm not an attorney, so I don't want to get into the legal ramifications, but essentially that's kind of the last resort, is just not spending money either on the capital side or on operating items to try to make sure we don't have a shortfall in the year.
I think there was a case involving Governor Sheffield that may be the only authority. And it was very fact-specific, I think.
Mr. Chairman, that's my understanding, is that the case was so fact-specific we can't necessarily draw, general rules. But, again, I'm not an attorney, and I don't want to wade into those territories.
Right. Let's go to slide 19.
So, Mr. Chairman, the next few slides are scenarios that you requested that envision what the final FY26 budget could look like. It's important to say these do not reflect final decisions. They're for illustration purposes only. They're not my scenarios as legislative finance. We don't come up with policy choices. These are the chairman's scenarios, and I'll walk through them, but again, they're representing sort of an illustration, not final decisions. And so there's five different scenarios with varying permanent fund dividend levels in this. So I'll go through, the first time I'll go through kind of all the items in more depth, and then in subsequent ones kind of stick to the dividend. So this first scenario is starts with the UGF revenue forecast, the $6.2 billion we saw in the first slide, and then removes the governor's amended operating budget and fund transfers. So this is sort of the surplus remaining of more fungible items. The first item we have here is a placeholder for new contracts. If you remember our overview presentation 6 weeks ago or so, we had had a $29.6 million placeholder. We've now increased that to 40 because we've started to get the contracts in, and the correctional officers are getting 11% rather than the 3% we had assumed. That's going above. The Mount Edgecombe teachers got 5.6%, I believe. Again, higher than 3%. So we've increased the 29.4 to 40. I'm not sure that that'll be sufficient at the end of the day, but again, it's a placeholder trying to get in the ballpark. Next item is the foundation formula increase for the $1,000 BSA increase. This is matching the original CS of House Bill 69. Again, the Rules Committee version came out $22 million higher. Item six is $7.3 million for the People Transportation Formula. That matches the amount that went outside the formula in FY25. That's not in House Bill 69. The governor's education bill includes a People Transportation Formula increase that's about twice this amount. But this is, again, this chairman may be able to speak to this, but this is a placeholder that's matching FY25's number. The next item, line 7 for community assistance. This is the additional amount that would be needed to add to the distribution in FY26 for a total distribution to communities of $30 million. Without any additional appropriations, that distribution would be $23.3 million. That would be enough to pay the base payments, but not enough to pay the full per capita payments. Line 8, the $7.5 million for child care would match the FY25 level. Line 9 and 10, these would match the fire suppression and disaster relief fund numbers in the governor's budget. Line 11 adds $10 million for the Alaska Marine Highway System backstop, which we discussed earlier in this presentation. And in the multi-year scenarios, we'll see it's increased to $76.5 million in FY28 when that money is the federal money is presumed to run out. For line 12, the capital budget, sort of the base capital budget, the base here is $300 million compared to GovAmend of $294, so pretty much the exact same, just rounding up. There's no funding for legislative additions of district projects. $50 million on the capital budget for deferred maintenance or school construction major maintenance, University of Alaska deferred maintenance. I think the chair mentioned additional renewable energy projects as another possibility. Essentially, that gets you to a $350 million capital budget all told between those two numbers without necessarily legislative district projects. And item 15, it does not include anything for fiscal notes to legislation beyond the people or the foundation number in line 5. $16 million in line 16, $40 million for subcommittee additions and other operating budget additions above the governor's number. I think the last subcommittee closes out tomorrow, and we should have kind of a better idea of where the House subcommittees ended up. And then finally, line 17 includes a dividend of the 75-25, so 25% of the percent of market value draw. That'd be about $1,400 per recipient and cost just about $950 million. That leaves us in line 19 with a deficit of $440 million in FY26 under this scenario. I know that's a lot of information in a row. I'll pause if there's questions before I move on to the other scenarios.
Yes, and I think the Superintendents Association and the School Board Association were hoping that item 5 would be $1,800, I think is the number. But our bill, the House Rules Bill is $1,000. Representative Allard.
Thank you, and through the chair. So I kind of went through these, Director Painter. I didn't see anything for a lower BSA. Was that not a scenario that was given just to kind of see if we can come closer to balancing our budget?
Through the chair, Representative Allard, I'll defer that one to the chairman, I suppose.
Well, it would be interesting to wonder whether, if we didn't, for example, have one-time funding of $182 million, I think, this is me thinking, the governor would be incredibly surprised because we had it this year. So the number that's proposed in the House Rules CS is larger than the 182 by about $60 million. We did not run the scenario you're talking about because that would have starved the school districts even more than they purport to be starved.
Starved. Okay. Thank you, Chair.
Representative Johnson.
So if I'm looking at this and there's a few bills out there that are already looking like they're going to probably go through. So if we talk about perhaps the defined benefit bill, I've got about $76 million for that one. I don't know if that's how that's going to end up or not. $200 million is what I have in my head for the BSA, although that's less by. I don't know. I guess it's not even on here, but that's a bill that's. So that would increase this by $200 million. 640, 640. I mean, is that right?
Through the chair, Representative Johnson, so the line five, the foundation formula increase would capture
okay.
the BSA.
Oh, okay, so yeah. $253 million. Okay, so, so we're at 440 with the BSA, and no, but that's the only bill that you've accounted for in there.
Through the chair, Representative Johnson, yes.
And
follow up.
Permission to dialogue somewhat.
Yes.
Thank you.
Yes, permission granted.
This is with no change, no addition to the capital budget at all. This is with the governor's capital budget only.
Through the chair, Representative Johnson, so it would be $6 million higher plus the $50 million for deferred maintenance and so forth. So,
okay.
So I guess $56 million higher than the governor's. Yeah.
Sorry, I should be looking at it a little closer. Okay, so, I mean, we're, by the time we get some bills, it looks like we're going to be looking at least $500 million. Absolute minimum. If we do, by some chance, I don't say we, but I mean if the proposal was to have a balanced budget with what you have, I mean, I guess I'm surprised we don't have that. What would that PFD end up being?
Through the chair, Representative Johnson, I believe that's scenario four or scenario five.
Oh, okay, sorry. I didn't look ahead.
And to be clear, Director, slide 20 shows red ink of $440 million. The governor's budget is about $1.5 billion, and really more because if you add in some one-time funding at a minimum, it would be more than $1.5 billion. Is that right,
Mr. Chairman? Yes. So you took the governor's budget and added his education bill, which is $120 million. You know, you'd get to 1.6 and almost would round up to 1.7 billion.
Yeah. Representative Stapp.
Yeah, thank you, Coach Adrosan. I have probably just a few things I'd like to run through on these items, if you could indulge me. Through the chair to Director Painter. So the first thing I notice off this community assistance slide, is the scenario just to capitalize the fund at $30 million, even though the statute is $90 million total capitalization? Through the chair, am I understanding that correctly?
Through the chair, Representative Stapp, this would give an additional amount for the distribution to make sure the distribution is $30 million. It would not add an additional amount to the fund to get back up to $90 million. So right now the fund has $70
million, correct,
leading to the 23.3. The governor's budget includes $30 million to add back, so you end up at, you know, 70-something million. So it doesn't propose, this doesn't include anything to bring that back up to 90. It just tops up the distribution this year only.
Okay, so basically the statute reads 1/3 of the capitalization funds distributed to the communities, and we're basically expending that, and then the fund would be down to $60 million, and then we'd have to recapitalize it at some point later. Is that correct in my understanding?
Through the chair, Representative Stapp, so the governor's budget includes the $30 million that's included here, so you'd run the fund from the current 70 down by 23.3, add 30, so you end up a little bit higher than where you started, right? $77 million or so. And then in FY27, a third of the balance would be 20-something million again. So you're not doing a full distribution, but the 6.7 would this year bring the distribution to the full 30, despite not having the full 90 in the fund.
Okay, cool. So that's the first one. Follow up, Mr. Kocher.
Yes, follow up.
So the second one is I noticed that there are $40 million in placeholders for contract negotiations, although I know that the elephant in the room is that salary study is still kind of floating out there, and we have pretty critical shortages, especially in DOT, Northern Region, Dalton Highway. And my thought, by kind of eyeballing that, is it looks to be relatively pricey, although I haven't seen the salary study, but just looking at comparative analysis and private sector wages, it looks around upwards of maybe $200 million in kind of wage increases that we're probably going to have to pay people in order to hire them, because if we don't, we will continue to have the vacancies. Are you comfortable with the $40 million in just placeholders through the CBA contracts, or do you see that number being higher through the chair?
Through the chair, Representative Stapp, I think the $40 million placeholder is probably a little bit on the low side. You know, that's based on essentially taking 3% for the unions where we don't yet have contracts, and then the percentages where we do have contracts, the actuals. But I think we may be underestimating a couple of the true impacts for some of the the marine highway unions, for example, where we don't have those in the personal services, so it's hard for me to estimate the true cost. But it's probably on the low side, yes.
Yeah, and just kind of on that line, Mr. Co-Chair.
Yes, Representative Stapp.
Can you remind me, we did the, I want to say, we did a unit last year, state employees, I forget that bargaining unit, right? But what was their salary increase? Was it 7% or was it, I want to say it was 7%. And that's going to be, I forget the bargaining, the big state employee union that we had the contracts last year.
Through the chair, Representative Stapp, so that was last year, the supervisory unit. That union received 5% plus one step, which is worth approximately 3.3%, so a total of about 8.3%. And so when you look at, like, the correctional officers, for example, they were up last year. They did not come to a contract, so they got 11% this year. But if you add the 3% that the supervisors are getting in FY26 plus the 8% they got in FY25, that kind of gets to where the correctional officers landed. So it's unclear to me exactly where the general government unit will land, but, you know, we use 3% because that's what the supervisory unit has for FY26.
And my last follow-up.
Last follow-up.
Yeah, thanks. So I noticed the rest of these slides are basically the only thing that changes is the PFD amount. And I know that I had asked you at the beginning of the year if you had the opportunity to model the 99-1, and I'm curious if that's modeled in any of these scenarios through the chair.
Through the chair, Representative Stapp, I don't believe the chairman asked for that one.
Okay. Thanks.
All right, let's go to slide 21.
Okay, the next slide, scenario 2, changes that PFD in line 17 to a $1,000 PFD, so the appropriation necessary to make a $1,000 dividend. That would reduce the deficit to $168.9 million. So it doesn't eliminate it, but reduces it substantially. Just for those who track these sort of things, the 680 includes the costs needed for the dividend program and then the projected recipients. It's not there's 680,000 recipients. There's also costs that are deducted off the top.
And This is $70 oil we're looking at here.
Mr. Chairman, yes.
Okay. All right, slide 22.
So slide 22 doubles that to $2,000 per recipient. The cost doesn't quite double because the fixed costs I mentioned, that is about $1.3 billion and increases the deficit to just over $800 million, $808.2 million.
Okay. All right. Creeping up where the governor suggests.
Yes. Mr. Chairman, scenario 4 shows the statutory dividend. Note that this is not the governor's number. This is the Permanent Fund Corporation's new number, so it's about $50 million lower. $2,455.5 million, that would pay about $3,800 per recipient and would result in a deficit of about $1.9
billion. Okay. Slide 24.
And then slide 24 answers the question of what would balance. So that would be $511.9 million, paying about $736 per recipient would result in a balanced FY26 budget under this scenario.
Okay. And I see I've got two colleagues with questions. But under this scenario, number 4 is not much of a variable because we typically pay contracts. 5 is a wild card, so to speak. I suppose 8 is. The capital budget, I suppose, could be smaller. 16 could be smaller. But there's not a lot of items here that can change a whole lot. Is that right?
Mr. Chairman, unless the legislature wants to make significant changes to the structure of the budget, but based on sort of our current structure, yeah, there's not a whole lot of wildly moving parts.
Representative Tomaszewski, followed by the co-chair.
Thank you, co-chair Josephson, through the chair. So scenario 5 here, just a moment ago, Representative Stapp asked about a 99-1. What's the POMV split on scenario 5? Looks to me like about a 99-something.
No. Through the chair, Representative Tomaszewski, I've pledged to myself not to do mental math in front on the table, at the table here, so I'll get back to the committee with the actual math.
Thank you.
I suspect it's around 83.17. It's sort of my best guess. Co-chair Shragi.
Thank you, Chair Josephson. And I guess maybe just jumping in the queue here to observe that adjusting the dividend amount is not the only solution before the legislature. We've talked about the CBR. There's also revenue measures being discussed in the other body. We don't know what the forecast will be next week, although I think not likely to change significantly, but I think there are a number of tools available to us here, and so we'll just have to continue having those difficult conversations.
Slide 25.
So the scenarios that we just showed were all one-year scenarios, so the next few slides turn those into three-year scenarios. So they essentially take that those FY26 decisions there, or the, not decisions, but the FY26 scenario, and then extend it by 2 years. So it assumes the existing schedules for statewide items, adding that school debt placeholder, assuming that the agency operations and capital budgets grow with inflation of 2.5%, and then adds a $50 million placeholder for future supplemental budgets, including in FY26, where that's not factored in. So in the first scenario, scenario one, this is showing the 75-25 PFD. And so we start with the deficit we saw before. We had the $50 million supplemental, so now that creeps up to 487.8. Across the 2 years, that would be a deficit of $654 million, 650, let's say. That is projected to grow in the next few years as revenue does not grow with inflation, but the other costs do, essentially. And then again in FY28, I mentioned it a couple of slides ago, but in FY28 there's an assumption that Marine Highway, the federal money, runs out and is replaced with UGF as well. So this is scenario one that corresponds to the 75-25 from a few slides ago.
Co-Chair Shragi.
Yeah, thank you, Chair Josephson. So two comments or questions on this slide. One is, in thinking about these numbers moving into the out years and thinking about the scenarios that we'll see in a moment, can you remind me, I think the S-Corp loophole has been talked a lot about. What is the amount that is projected to be brought in if we were to close the S-Corp loophole? Because that would take down the annual deficit. The second part of my question is, can you remind me what the balance in the CBR is? I don't think running annual deficits is sustainable, but I do think that there's a general view in the legislature that in the future we may have more of an appetite for fiscal reform, and so I'm thinking, what is our ability to weather annual deficits for some time? So can you remind me what would be the projected income brought in by closing the S-Corp loophole, and then what is the balance of the CBR that we would be pulling from if we ran annual deficits for the next 3 years, and then this one as well?
Co-Chair Shragi, so the S-Corp legislation as proposed in the other body, the first year is sort of a year and a half's worth because it takes effect retroactively. So you get, like, I think $180 million the first year and then something like $120 the next couple of years, if I'm remembering that right. And I'll get back to the committee with a more precise number. That's just the number that sticks in my head, is something like $120 million a year. The CBR balance is currently about $3 billion.
Thank you.
And before I go to Representative Allard, I asked my staff to look at CBR balances. I think in 21 or 22 it was down to $1.3 billion. So our CBR balance is more than twice its lowest recent point. Does that sound familiar?
Mr. Chairman, yes, that's correct.
Representative Allard.
Thank you, and through the chair. I appreciate the comments from my colleague from Anchorage, but the S-Corp isn't a loophole. It's actually in statute, right?
Through the chair, Representative Allard, yes, there's no tax on S-Corps currently.
Thank you.
Representative Stapp.
Thank you, Co-Chair Justin, through the chair to Director Painter. I see that your slides have lots of red, and they continue to have lots of red as I turn the pages. My memory serves me on budget stuff that red is not good. That means I don't have the money for these things. I've noticed that as the subcommittee closeouts are taking place, the red is getting more redder through the chair. And I'm curious, I haven't heard any revenue proposals from my illustrious colleagues in the majority yet. By the math that you just gave us, the S-corp taxation method doesn't generate enough money to cover the red. So my question to you is, what should we do to have the red turned to black, through the chair?
Director.
Through the chair, Representative Stapp, that is a policy choice that I can't really weigh in on. There's a number of alternatives you would have in terms of revenue generation or spending reductions.
In a fault, Mr. Co-Chair?
Yes, and Representative Stapp, I would note that you're right, that, for example, yesterday in subcommittee, because there was no other source to pay it, we wanted to continue to have forensic exams of sexually abused children done, because we thought that was important. And so we're going to ask you to participate in spending $5.5 million for that service. We hope you'll do that. Representative Stapp.
Oh, thank you, Co-Chair Jefferson. I do actually support that. I think that's relatively important. I do think the $5.5 million for, I guess we call them rape kits, right? I mean, that's obviously valuable and important, but that's not the $653 million red number on the screen. So I think, my question is, what happens if we were to send an unbalanced budget to the governor? What does the governor do, through the chair?
Through the chair, Representative Stapp, the last time that happened was Governor Walker was the governor, and he vetoed down to the funded amount. So he vetoed kind of across the board down to the amount needed to have a balanced budget.
So my last fault, Mr. Co-Chair.
You bet. Follow up.
Thank you. So basically what you're saying is if we fail as a finance committee to balance our budget, then the big man on the third floor is going to take care of that for us through the chair.
Through the chair, Representative Stapp. In order to sign the budget, he would have to, yes.
Thank you.
Okay. Last question, Co-Chair Shiragi.
Yeah, thank you. We have the ability to run deficit budgets so long as there's a funding source available to fill that deficit for the year. If you could affirm that that's correct, and then before I have you answer that question, I just note that some of these things, for example, funding education is a constitutional obligation that we have to balance with the rest of our constitutional obligations. It's not simply a fiduciary duty that we have. Our duties go beyond that. But if you could answer the question that I had at the beginning there.
Director.
Chair Representative Shiragi, yes, we can run a deficit as long as there's a deficit filling source available. So, we drew $3 billion a year from the CBR for a five-year period, for example.
Thank you.
Okay. Director Painter, outstanding work as usual. Seeing no other questions for our director, I'd like to thank him for his presentation. Our next scheduled House Finance Committee meeting is Thursday, the 6th of March. That would be tomorrow at 1:30. At that meeting, we will begin to hear subcommittee closeout reports. We'll adjourn this meeting at 3:20 p.m.